Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. I expect that most Americans would agree that the freedom of religion is one of the most important rights that we have. At the same time, there's reason to believe that significant numbers of Americans don't define religious liberty as a universal right for everyone. That is, to be clear, they believe in the freedom of religion for themselves and people who believe as they do, but not necessarily for people who believe different things. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the erosion of religious freedom in the United States and abroad, and we have two guests joining us. Charles Haynes is a senior scholar at the First Amendment Center. He directs the center's First Amendment educational program in schools and addresses issues concerning religious liberty in American public life. He's best known for helping schools and communities find common ground on conflicts involving religion and values in schools. He holds a master's degree in religion and education from Harvard Divinity School and a doctorate in theological studies from Emory University. Our second guest is John Whitty. He is the Jonas Robicheaux Professor of Law and Ethics and Director of the Center for the Study of Law and Religion at Emory University in Atlanta. He's a specialist in legal history, marriage, and religious liberty. He's authored a number of books, including Modern Christian Teachings on Law, Politics, and Human Nature, and Religion and the American Constitutional Experiment. Both of our guests were honorees this year of the Council for America's First Freedom. This is a group based in Richmond, Virginia, that's interested in promoting understanding and respect for the freedom of religion. And every year in January, they hand out First Freedom Awards to individuals whose actions have made a significant difference. And as I say, our guests were among the honorees this year. As we talk this morning, of course, questions are welcome. As always, the only thing we ask of callers, and we do invite callers as they try to keep their comments brief, so that we can keep moving and get in as many different people as possible. But certainly, you are welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, over the air around Illinois, Indiana, or on the Internet around the United States. And the toll-free line is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. And then we say hello to our guests here. Dr. Haynes joining us by phone. Hello.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And Professor Whitty, thank you.
Thank you, David. Here. Appreciate you being here.
And I know it sounds as if he's here. We are doing one of these high-quality connections. And so sound is very good, but he's not here. He's in Atlanta. Well, I thank you both very much for being with us. I thought it would be interesting here to start for me to ask Charles Haynes to talk a little bit about the survey that your organization did, and that's where I got this idea I mentioned right at the beginning, looking at Americans and their ideas about religious freedom. And one of the things that you found was that while there is a majority of Americans who said that freedom of worship should extend to everyone, people of all religious groups, that there's still a significant number of people who apparently aren't willing to agree with that statement.
Well, that's right. I think that was one of the most disturbing findings. 28% of the American people, according to this survey anyway, believe that freedom to worship as one chooses was never meant to apply to religious groups that the majority of the people consider extreme or on the fringe. There's a lot packed in there that's disturbing. I mean, if the majority of the people can decide who gets freedom of worship and who does not, then, of course, in the 18th century, Baptists would have been not permitted to worship, and 19th century might have been Catholics, and 20th century Jehovah's Witnesses, and today, fill in the blank. But I do think post 9/11 in the United States, there is a lot of fear and concern about religion and minority religions, particularly Islam, and I think this finding reflects that fear.
Mm. And can one say that in this respect, that is in Americans' feelings about religious freedom and who is covered, that there has been some sort of trend here, and there has in fact been a kind of a decline in the number of people who are willing to say, yes, religious freedom applies to everyone?
That's fair to say. I think when we took this poll a number of years ago asking this question, the numbers were better religious freedom for everyone, whether people think the group is on the fringe or extreme or not, and that's declined. There are other measures as well. I think we have we see that a great many Americans today support a number of majoritarian, I call it, approaches to religion and public life. They think the majority faith, in fact, should be privileged. And we see that in terms of what they think schools should be doing. They want teacher-led prayers by about 58%. 43% of the American people, according to this poll, think holiday programs in schools should be entirely Christian, and so forth. So I think there are a number of indicators that suggest to us that there has been an erosion in recent years, a kind of downturn, in support for what I would consider full religious freedom and a level playing field for people of all faiths in this country and of no faith.
I'd like to turn to Professor Witte and see if you could perhaps put this in a little bit of an historical context. From what Dr. Haynes says, one would have to believe that through American history, or at least going back to when we wrote up these rights, that we had difficulty with the notion that it should extend to everybody, and there always were certain groups, smaller religious groups that didn't always get the same consideration and the same protection. So, having said that, do you think that at this point where we are now, that the issue is that religious freedom is in any more jeopardy now than it ever has been?
Well, a couple different comments about that. One, I think I agree with Dr. Haynes about the increasing sentiment that majoritarian religions count and minority religions have to fend for themselves. And that's of a piece, actually, with a move in First Amendment free exercise law that reduces the kind of protection that the free exercise clause gives to religious minorities through the federal courts and leaves those parties to the caprice and generosity of legislatures. And inevitably, when the legislature, rather than the federal court, is making a determination as to whether a hated minority gets protection, legislators will go with majoritarian will. Secondly, I think in terms of the historical record, you have to draw a distinction between the reach of the First Amendment Free Exercise Clause and the reach of comparable provisions in state constitutions in the 18th century. State constitutions were transparently discriminatory in a number of different states, either privileging one established religion, reaching only to the Christian faith or to the Protestant faith, depending upon the state. But ironically, or perhaps triumphantly, the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment did not have those built-in limitations. And the Free Exercise Clause was forged with an eye to including all peaceable religions, with recognizing that Catholics and Jews, hated minorities in the day, nonetheless deserved free exercise protection. And that ideal of being very inclusive in who counted in the Constitutional Convention and in the First Amendment's calibrations, and recognizing that national free exercise rights were to extend to all, really set the country off on the right constitutional path, even though it took 150 years before those rights became real for a number of the minorities. So I think the constitutional text itself is rich with inclusivity, and the under-interpretation, in my view, of that text in recent years has jeopardized that reach. Mm.
We have a caller already to bring into the conversation. Let's just do that. We'll go to our line number one, and this person is listening in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'd like to raise a couple of points and let your guests discuss them. I'd like to start by saying I am a minority religion, whatever that means. So from that point of view, I have a number of issues that I'd like to bring up, some of which I think your guests might have interesting comments to make. These are all from the recent events in the last 2 years. First is religious freedom, apropos an issue that arose in Minnesota, I'm not sure where in Minnesota, regarding Muslim cab drivers refusing to pick up or carry people who had alcohol in their baggage from the airport. A second issue has to do with the current, animosity expressed towards Mitt Romney regarding his Mormonism and all sorts of issues dealing with Mormonism. There was an article actually this morning in the Wall Street Journal regarding this, and I think that's something that's very valuable to explore. A third issue, it has to do with the attempt to impose cultural standards from another society, whether Islamic, in terms of issues such as honor killings, such as one that was a possible honor killing that recently occurred in Texas, or the use of bushmeat, meaning the killing of apes and other members of the other primates, and importing that meat into the United States by African immigrants who claim this is part of their religious and cultural tradition. And the last thing, and then I'll just get off and listen on the air, is the recent comments by the Archbishop of Canterbury, which have drawn a tremendous amount of outrage in England, or I should say at least controversy, about that Sharia law might be considered as something that should be applied alongside British law in Great Britain. So I've thrown out a number of areas which I think are all interrelated, and I'd love to hear the comments.
All right. Thank you. Well, the caller has given us enough to keep us going for several hours, I guess. I'll start here probably. Let me start with Dr. Haynes, and if you want to pick a couple of things off that list and talk, you can go right ahead.
Well, all I can say, this is a very informed caller and someone who really follows this closely, and those are all very interesting and sophisticated questions. Let me just say a couple of things, because Professor Witte knows a lot more about some of these than I do, I'm sure, but the cab drivers in Minneapolis Airport, that raises the question of where do we draw the line on religious accommodation in the workplace, and that's not easy to draw, and there's no simple answer. My own view is that we should try our best to accommodate claims of conscience, religious conscience, in the workplace when we can. So, for example, if the cab drivers could be accommodated, if passengers can easily get an alternative cab and so forth, if it can be worked out in a way that keeps them on the job, but also allows them to uphold their faith, then I personally think we should try to do that. That's an unpopular view, because when I wrote about this, I got lots of people saying, no, that's we shouldn't even try to accommodate. I think the same with pharmacists, actually, who say they can, on grounds of conscience, to give out certain kinds of prescriptions. I think we should try to protect their conscience if we can. In other words, if the customer can get another pharmacist to fill the prescription. So I'm all for religious accommodation, because I think one of the great founding principles of the country is, of course, liberty of conscience for every person. And the role of the government is to protect the rights of people to follow their conscience, to do what they believe they must do to uphold their faith. So where we can, I'm for trying to accommodate. And that's tough, and as I say, I think that's increasingly unpopular in our culture today. There's much more to say. I'd be interested to hear what Professor Witte thinks about the accommodation issue, and maybe we can pick up some of these other important issues after that.
Sure.
Fully agreed. This is a highly informed caller, and I appreciate all four lines of inquiry. I largely concur with Dr. Haynes on the question of the Muslim cabs and accommodating them, and I like the general call to prudent accommodation. We have to recognize that we're in a sub-constitutional, a sub-free exercise right universe here in terms of there is no free exercise right to have a license to operate a cab, and there's no free exercise right to take a cab under certain conditions. So in many ways, we're in a world that requires more prudent accommodation, even if it's not necessarily driven by constitutional free exercise values. The caller's question about the accommodation of the cultural standards of other society, I think, is an interesting one. And we encounter this a number of times in new immigrant groups like the Santerians or who of African descent, whose unusual rituals in Hialeah, Florida, were ultimately accommodated by the U.S. Supreme Court in a 1993 case dealing with the city of Hialeah. But there's a limit to how far free exercise can go. There's no free exercise right to violate or threaten the life and limb of another. And so honor killings as a matter of constitutional right would never be respected. It's countered by the absolute right to life that the other party has. And if it's a choice between the two, the free exercise right has to yield. It's a harder question about use of bushmeat for African rituals that have now been exported to the United States. We deal with that kind of question in a case that's still pending in the federal courts with a hallucinogenic tea, a Waxa tea, which Waxa is a Schedule I narcotic substance. It's generally prohibited, but if it's used as part of a ritual by an expatriate Brazilian group practicing their religion peaceably and voluntarily in the United States, can they be accommodated? That's an issue that's currently being mooted in the courts, and it's going to be dealt with in a comparable way with this question of bushmeat. Depends on how severe the violation of various animal protection laws is, but one can see that one being accommodated. The issue of the Archbishop of Canterbury's comments and the use of Sharia in many ways is anticipating a big, hard question that we're going to face in the United States, and that is the question of to what extent may religious communities become a law unto themselves when it comes to issues of marriage formation, maintenance, dissolution, child care, control, custody, parental rights, parent-child relationships. And it's a question that has faced us throughout the history of the United States, largely in a subconstitutional way. But I think these questions are going to come for greater public scrutiny, eventually judicial scrutiny. The question is to what extent can the Catholic Church or Protestant churches or Jewish rabbis or Muslim Sharia courts exercise a level of jurisdiction over their voluntary membership? Can parties opt out of the state marriage and family law into the religious law that is operating in the religious community of which they're voluntary members? In reality, we accommodate this in a variety of different ways by allowing religious communities to exercise the right to declare a marriage. By the law vested in me, I hereby declare you man and wife. We recognize the right of Jewish rabbis to determine whether a Orthodox Jewish couple can be divorced, no state divorce until the party gets a religious divorce. We're accommodating de facto the practices of fundamentalist Mormons with the 30,000 polygamous families that exist with impunity under bigamy laws in various Western states and who are operating now in effect under the jurisdiction of the fundamentalist Mormon religious leadership. And increasingly, the question is going to become, can we extend that to other peaceable faiths, like Muslims? And we do this in the education area. We do that where we have basically said, yes, the state has an education system. Parties are required to be educated, but we will allow for the education to be discharged by religious schools. We'll set baselines that cannot be violated, but religious parties can add to those baselines in the education they give to their voluntary membership. The question is whether a comparable such covenant can eventually be worked out in the marriage and family area, where certain questions are delegated to or ceded to religious communities with baseline set that cannot be trespassed, but with this religious community is receiving semi-autonomy from the state to discharge certain things that are now currently being exclusively done by the state. That is a big, brave world of constitutional law that we're going to face over the next 50 years, in my view, and it's not at all clear to me how that's going to be resolved.
Let me introduce again the two guests for anyone who has just tuned in. The last person you heard is John Witte. He's professor of law and ethics and director of the Center for the Study of Law and Religion at Emory University in Atlanta. He's a specialist in legal history, marriage, and religious liberty. Also joining us is Dr. Charles Haynes. He's a senior scholar at the First Amendment Center that's based in Arlington, Virginia. He directs the Center's educational program in schools and is best known for helping schools and communities find some common ground on conflicts involving religion and values in public schools. And I guess just before going, I have another caller here. Before going on, I want to go back to Dr. Haynes and just say that the caller's questions, all of them point to, I think, the challenge that we have here in the United States, and perhaps it's a challenge that other countries face as well. The challenge being, how do we, if we have made a commitment to religious pluralism, how do we, on the one hand, give various religious groups autonomy to practice and believe as they choose, and at the same time maintain our commitment to some kind of common set of values that's going to transcend the individual differences? It's great that to say that that's what we want to do, but is it actually possible to do that?
Oh, I think it is. I mean, I think the United States, with all the challenges we've talked about and will talk about today, the United States still remains, I think, the boldest and most successful experiment in religious liberty the world has ever seen. And here we are, the most religiously diverse place on Earth, I think, and among developed nations, certainly one of the most religious. And nevertheless, we manage and fairly well to live with one another across these differences. So I think what we have in common that allows us to do that are these core principles of religious freedom in the First Amendment, the Constitution. And those are the ground rules, if you will, that enable us to engage one another, negotiate our differences. Creating the level playing field within those ground rules is, of course, an ongoing challenge. And I don't know that it's an ideal we keep working toward. We have to keep working toward it. And maybe we backslid a little bit in recent years. I think we have. But I think, on the whole, the movement is forward. And we've managed to, have new voices in the public square and have them heard and taken seriously in ways that I don't know that you can find anywhere else in the world. So, I think we have to keep that in mind as we talk about the challenges we face. And the caller mentioned Mitt Romney and the Mormon question, and I think that's an interesting case study for how well we're doing. And I think in some ways we're doing quite well. People in the United States, I think, are willing to vote for people without making their faith or their particular religious expression kind of litmus test. But I think this campaign shows that we still have a ways to go, particularly with Mitt Romney. I think it was a factor. It did hold him back, in spite of the fact that, of course, legally under the Constitution, there is no religious test for office. But there are these informal tests that we apply as American citizens, and that's still disturbing to me, at least. And I think this campaign has altogether too much God talk that is, does in fact, I think, trigger some of that prejudice. When one candidate advertises himself as a Christian leader and others are sort of scrambling to show that they're more Christian than the other, I don't think that's... I'm all for people expressing their faith in the campaign and saying what they believe. I think that's an important part of our dialogue in America, for people to talk about what they believe religiously and openly and freely, including candidates for office. So I'm not questioning that. But I am concerned when that goes in the direction of suggesting that, in fact, there's a kind of litmus test for who is the more acceptable presidential candidate, the more Christian you are, the more acceptable you are. And I think that's a kind of dangerous road to go down.
All right. Let's talk with another caller here in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would suggest that there is a difference between the permission of the use of a hallucinogen in religious ceremony, which I think there's a precedent for some of the Native American tribes, and the use of bushmeat. The species which are being butchered for bushmeat are highly endangered species. They are internationally protected. And there is a second problem, that they offer a high degree of danger of the transmission of very lethal diseases. We know that HIV was contracted from the eating of bushmeat in all likelihood, and it's quite possible that Ebola could be transmitted through this agency. And so I think there is both a matter of conservation and also a public health a consideration. And I would submit that. Thank you.
Well, all right. Dr. Witte, I don't know if you want to comment on that.
Points well taken, and certainly those data would need to be put before any prosecutor that's seeking to prosecute this transplanted African religious community for their violation of national and international laws against butchery of and use of primate meat. I think from a bare legal perspective, the issue is going to be how serious the crime is of transport and use and consumption of bushmeat versus transport, use, and consumption of an hallucinogenic Schedule I substance. And it's at that level of inquiry that the precedents about the use of hallucinogens are going to be useful. If a serious federal felony nonetheless will be excused because the party making use of the Schedule I substance is exercising a free exercise right or a Religious Freedom Restoration Act right, then the argument can easily be made that a comparable excuse from a federal felony for using bushmeat should apply as well. And failure so to do is in many ways a form of religious discrimination against the second group. And that would be the kind of argument that I would encourage litigants to press that are using RFRA or free exercise claims.
Hmm. All right. Let's go on to Bloomington, Indiana next, line number 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. The idea of having to defer to Sharia law or any other non-Christian law as an aspect of the free exercise of religion would find no sympathy among our founding fathers. The Supreme Court has changed the idea of exercise of religion to any expression at all of religion. But as the Supreme Court found in the Trinity case, this is an 1892 case, the Church of the Holy Trinity versus United States, that court found unequivocally, we are a Christian people. One of the quotations from that case, the court quotes a case, Updegraff versus the Commonwealth, quote, it was decided that Christianity, general Christianity, is and always has been part of the common law of Pennsylvania. Now, they're quoting that. This is the Supreme Court quoting the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. They say it is not Christianity with an established church, that's an establishment of religion, with tithes and spiritual courts, but Christianity with liberty and conscience to all people. Further, they go on to say that the expressions of to revile with malicious and blasphemous contempt the religion professed by almost the whole community is an abuse of that right, nor are we bound by any expressions in the Constitution, as some have strangely supposed, either not to punish at all or to punish indiscriminately like attacks upon the religion of Mohammed or of the Grand Lama. And for this plain reason, that the case assumes that we are a Christian people and that the morality of the country is deeply engrafted upon Christianity and not upon the doctrines or worship of those imposters, unquote.
Well, I guess this is one for Professor Witte to respond to. You're the expert on the Constitution and religion.
Well, I'm not the expert that Dr. Haynes is, but I'll try. First of all, the case of 1892 is quoted aptly, as our learned colleague has offered. But the holding in the case is that the Supreme Court refused to apply a new federal law forbidding contracts with foreign aliens to a church that was seeking to hire a foreign cleric. And the case, for all of its vituperative rhetoric, actually was a olive branch being held out to the Catholic Church, which at the time was being pilloried by legislators and states in most untoward ways. Secondly, I think it's important to recognize that what we're talking about is the law of the 21st century, not the law of the 19th century, a law that has accreted with Supreme Court case law over time, with 140 cases since 1892 on point dealing with the First Amendment Free Exercise and Establishment Clause, to the point today that the Free Exercise Clause, even in its more muted form since 1990, does protect religious communities in the exercise of their law over their voluntary membership. And that issue is beyond dispute. Intra-church disputes over property are resolved internally by the religious communities themselves. Education that the religious communities offer are protected. Various rights for those religious communities to engage in internal discrimination to protect them from having to hire somebody of a different faith for core religious functions. All these things have been protected under the Free Exercise Clause, or the Supreme Court has endorsed statutes protecting the same, and the list can go on. And the issue that's before us now is not whether dicta of the 19th century are still useful for deciding whether a Christian nation or a non-Christian nation, but addressing the reality that we're a vastly pluralistic nation and have chosen to accommodate various forms of religious identity and organization under the Free Exercise Clause. And the hard question becomes, how far will that go?
Well, let me turn then to Charles Haynes, because I think that the point that the caller is trying to make and has made before in previous calls, and I'm sure that there are many people across the country would agree with him, the idea being that the United States is a Christian nation, always has been, that the founders were Christians, that the founding documents were grounded in Christian thought, and that that's something that was true then and is true now.
Well, the Christian nation language is slippery, and it can mean many things, and I think probably people hearing it right now are thinking different things. So I think that's why one would have to pin down a little bit exactly what we mean by it. If we mean demographically, then yes, most Americans consider themselves today Christian, if you ask them, some 85%. Of course, that covers a lot of different beliefs, and I'm not sure you'd get much agreement in that 85% as to what really is Christian and not. Nevertheless, just descriptively, there are most people call themselves Christian. But to suggest that in any sense we are established under the Constitution as a Christian nation is a use of Christian nation language that I think is wrong not only today, but I think it really would be wrong through our history. We asked people in our recent poll whether or not the United States Constitution establishes a Christian nation, and 55% of the American people, according to this poll, think it does. But I think that's largely because of the misuse of this language about Christian nation. I think it has, frankly, misinformed a great many Americans about what that means. For people to argue for a society or a culture that reflects Christian values and standards, well, that's their right to do as citizens. It's all of our right to bring our religious views into the public arena and argue for the kind of country we want. But to suggest that somehow that the Constitution officially established back then or today a Christian nation, I think, of course, is just wrong as a matter of history and in fact. I mean, just beginning with the fact that there's no religious test for public office, we can't possibly be a Christian nation. Because we can't have, we can't impose a religious test, Christians ruling the nation. And then, of course, getting to the First Amendment, it's an arrangement that, again, precludes an establishment of Christianity over other faiths. So I think that we have to be very careful about the use of this language and sort out what exactly we mean. And be sure not to suggest to the American people, and I think this is important for political leaders right now running for office, not to suggest to the American people that one faith should be privileged over others by the government. That's the key here. We don't want the government to take sides in religion and to somehow privilege Christianity above other faiths.
We just have about 15 minutes left. I have other callers. I want to try to give them a chance to get in some of their thoughts. And also for people who might have just tuned in, I want to introduce again our guests. Joining us by telephone is Charles Haynes. He's a senior scholar at the First Amendment Center based in Arlington, Virginia. He directs the center's First Amendment educational program in schools and addresses issues concerning religious liberty in American public life. He holds master's degree in religion and education from Harvard Divinity School and doctorate in theological studies from Emory University. Also joining us from Emory is John Whitty. He's professor of law and ethics and director of the Center for the Study of Law and Religion at Emory University in Atlanta. Questions welcome. We'll try to get in as many as we can. We do have two people ready to go, and next we'll go to someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi. Regarding the notion that the country was Christian to begin with, you have to define what a Christian is. And I would argue that a Christian, one of the defining characteristics of Christianity is the belief in the Trinity. Well, it turns out that most of these people back then, or a lot of them anyway, including John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, were either Unitarians or sympathetic to Unitarianism, which rejects the Trinity. So I would argue that they aren't Christian at all. And these are the people who founded the country. Benjamin Franklin probably had no religion whatsoever. And to say that we were based in Christianity is just absolute nonsense to me.
Well,
I'll take my answer off here.
All right. Dr. Haynes, you want to respond to that?
Well, I think that points out that this history is complex, and it's. I think the caller is right, that our framers had different views. When people say to me they meant this or that, they meant to establish a complete separation of church and state, or no, they meant for religion to be, Christianity to be privileged, in a sense they're both right, because some of the framers were deeply orthodox in their Christianity and worried about the maintaining the Christian nature of the country, Alexander Hamilton, for example, whereas others, as the caller points out, were deists or had other views, or nominal Christians in some cases. George Washington, for example, didn't take the Lord's Supper, though he attended church. It was complex, so that other framers would have had a different view about what kind of society and church-state relationship they envisioned. So they debated that then. We debate it now. But I think what the important point is that what they did in the Constitution was to make sure that this arrangement is one of religious freedom, even though we're going to argue then and now about exactly what that looks like. I think there, in broad terms, we agree, most Americans agree, that we don't want the government involved in religion or in somehow privileging one religion over others. And we also agree that we want to protect the rights of everyone to practice their religion as they choose.
Yeah, just add one point,
sure.
David.
Mm-hmm.
All fully agreed on Dr. Haynes' comments that it's very important to understand the framers of the First Amendment said free exercise of religion. They didn't say religious worship or religious assembly or anything else. They said free exercise of religion. And that was a deliberate choice that you can document quite clearly in some of the debates of the time and in the subsequent reflections by the drafters of the First Amendment, that they wanted to leave that term as open as possible, contrary to a number of the states that were much more specific about what forms of religion were protected and what forums for religious expression should be protected. I think the First Amendment, by its very terms, independent of the inquiries about the nature of the religious beliefs of the founders, is an invitation to openness about what the definition of religion is, but a recognition that religion is important to the polity, however defined.
Let's talk with another caller. This is someone in Urbana and on line number two.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like your comment. Historically, it seems that governments really don't have an issue with religion until there is a political component, and then they seem to be willing to use their full range of powers to deal with them accordingly. How do you deal with a quasi-political religious organization? Thank you.
All right. And I don't know. Well, I'll give the John Whitty, Professor Whitty, a chance to respond first. I guess I'm not exactly sure what that I'm sorry that the caller didn't give us an example of what he thought such an organization would be.
I guess one of the questions would turn on whether a party can seek or a group can seek free exercise protection for a transparently political activity that is cloaked in religious language. And that's a real hard question about what are the limits of constitutional protection that we will accord a party, and when is religion being used as a mere cloak and a sham. And that's a really hard line that has to be negotiated case by case. We have the Supreme Court, as it's spoken to this question, has basically said, look, sincere good faith claims, however individual, idiosyncratic, or newly acquired, need to be protected presumptively under the Free Exercise Clause, or at least parties must be given standing to press that claim. It doesn't mean they're going to win, but they at least can get their day in court. And in many ways, charlatanism is a cost we have to bear in order to ensure free exercise rights for all. But parties that misuse the Free Exercise Clause or misuse statutory rights that turn upon religious identity find themselves rather quickly in trouble with not so much the federal courts but with various agencies like the Internal Revenue Service that will deny them 501c3 organization status, with local tax commissioners that will withdraw their tax exemption for their properties or sale and use tax exemptions that they might enjoy. They may well lose their religious incorporation status. The costs of charlatanism, while borne constitutionally, may well ultimately be visited upon those that misuse religion for political ends at the local level. Charles probably has something better to say about that.
No, not better, but I will just add that there's a debate going on today, of course, about whether or not the IRS regulations concerning tax exemption for religious groups should be revisited and should be revised. There are those who say that there should be more free speech, if you will, or free exercise protection for pastors and churches to take sides in political contests or in campaigns. Right now, they're prohibited from doing so, except as individuals outside their on their own, but they can't speak for the church, and churches that are tax-exempt can't get involved in political campaigns. There are those, and many in Congress, who've been pushing to change that and to tell the IRS that you need to change your regulations to allow religious groups to take positions in political campaigns or for particular candidates and maintain their tax exemption. That's a very hot debate. It hasn't gone far in Congress yet, but it has a lot of support. So I think this is one of those issues that will continue to be debated as more and more religious groups press to be part of the political discussion.
Right. Next caller is in Indiana, in Terre Haute, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Good afternoon,
yes.
Or good morning,
yes.
Wherever you are. I'm coming in a bit late on the conversation, but I keep hearing the word protect, protect, protect. And I'm curious to know what the guests would say religion is being protected from. Is it the government? Is it other religions? If they would speak to that as to what the framers may have had in mind as to what protect means, I would be interested to know. Thank you.
All right.
Well, if it's a constitutional question, it's protection from government. There are plenty of instances where one private party violates the religious rights of another private party, and while those may be violations, those are not where the Constitution is going to spend its time. Those violations can be addressed through civil suits, a tort. In serious cases, they may give rise to criminal prosecution for a crime against another party. But when we're talking about constitutional protection for religion, it's constitutional protection for religion from government interference in all kinds of different ways.
And there's an effort underway in Congress, and it has been for a number of years, it just hasn't gotten through yet, to give a higher level of protection to religious people in the private workplace, which, again, is not addressed as a First Amendment issue, but through legislation, the idea is to ensure that people in the workplace who need some religious accommodation are treated or given the opportunity to make the case for religious accommodation in the workplace for holidays and so forth. So there is an ongoing discussion about how to address questions of discrimination, and especially in the private workplace, or other forms of discrimination that take place. And we have now, under this administration, we have a an office in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department that deals with these kinds of issues and complaints of discrimination, whether it's in zoning or in the workplace or in other ways. Well, of course, zoning would be government, but there are a lot of other areas where the government gets involved through various other pieces of legislation or regulation to try, at least, to protect the rights of people to practice their faith. And I think under this Justice Department, actually, there's been a lot of good intervention on behalf of many different religious groups around the country, Sikhs, Muslims, Christians, others, when they have brought a complaint that their civil rights have been violated.
We just have
can I say one thing?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
I'm so sorry. Charles is right, and I this is an ironic byproduct of the truncation of the free exercise protection that that is afforded since 1990, when the Supreme Court said neutral, generally applicable laws will pass constitutional muster, even if a party's sincere, good faith beliefs are being crushed. One of the consequences of that is that we have shifted from the constitutional text to statutory text to do a lot of the work that the Free Exercise Clause historically had done for religious parties of all sorts, particularly religious minorities. And one of the ironic byproducts is we have a slate of legislation now in the last 17 years that exactly targets various kinds of rights that are being violated by other private parties, and that gives parties federal and sometimes state statutory remedies and a standing in court to press those for those remedies.
We just have about 2 minutes left, and there is one thing that I wanted to talk about. Unfortunately, we don't really have enough time, but and particularly I'll pitch this one to Dr. Haynes, and it has to do with religion in public schools. And if you ask people, a lot of people, about their concerns about religion in public life today, from a lot of people, what you'll hear is their concerns that religion has been banned from the public schools. How do you, when someone says that to you, how do you react?
Well, that's just not true. And I know that because I work with public schools across the country and have for the last 20-some years on this issue. And I can tell your listeners that there's probably more student religious expression in public schools today than there has been at any time over the past 100 years. Now, that doesn't mean that all schools are getting this right. But I think if you compare public education to 2 decades ago, when very little was discussed about religion in the curriculum, it was just absent. When students had very few religious liberty rights, there were no student religious clubs, and so forth. Compared today, when there are hundreds, if not thousands, of student religious clubs in public schools, we're teaching much more about religion in the curriculum academically. Students have other rights. They can share their faith with others and bring their scriptures to school and so forth. It's a whole new world in public education today. We still have a lot of work to do, because a lot of school districts still don't have good policies in this area and still make mistakes or misunderstand the First Amendment. We still have some issues about which we disagree. But most of these issues have been agreed to, and we are closer today to getting it right in public schools under the First Amendment than we have been in many, many years.
Hmm. Let me just ask Professor Witte, you want to comment on that?
Amen.
you would say that in many places that they're doing a good job in walking that line between the two parts of the First Amendment, the one that has to do with establishment of religion and whether or not government is getting involved in telling people what they should believe, and the other part being that there is this guarantee that people will have the right to practice their religion.
Well, they're doing a better job.
Yeah.
I think many public schools still need good policies, and they need to work at this, but they have no choice but to deal with religion now, because it's coming in through the door. The U.S. Department of Education guidelines really indicate these are the things you should be doing. Court rulings have said these are the rights students have in public schools. So, I mean, whether schools want to or not, or whether they like it or not, there's a lot of religious expression now in public education through the student doorway. And I think the issue for public schools is, how do we really make sure that this is done in a way that protects everyone? How do we have strong policies and prepare teachers and administrators to deal with it? And so I would say on that side, We have still many schools that are just allowing this to happen without working at it. And we have a smaller number of schools who are doing the right thing and being proactive on this issue.
Hmm. And Dr. Haynes is one of the champions of this and has been the architect of a number of very fine policies around the country that are worthy of implementation. And I think this is a really interesting Hegelian story. I mean, we've had two extremes of various forms of Protestant Christianity that were in place in public schools before the 40s, a gradual Supreme Court-led evisceration of all religion from the public schools in the 70s, and then now we've kind of come to a via media where we can understand that there are private free exercise rights to express religion, that religion is part of the curriculum in an objective way, that there are forms of religious expression that are worthy of consideration, and that the liberal education of a child is to be prepared for all of life, and he or she upon graduation is going to confront religion in the public square and best to expose that student to that religion properly in an educational environment than to make it something like alcohol that's banned until one's 18.
Well, we will have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of the time. We want to thank our guests, John Witte. He's professor of law and ethics and also director of the Center for the Study of Law and Religion at Emory University in Atlanta. Professor Witte, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
And also thanks to the folks there at the other end of our high-quality connection there at Emory. And also our thanks to Dr. Charles Haynes. He is a senior scholar at the First Amendment Center, which is based in Arlington, Virginia. They're very interested in particularly in schools and how schools deal with conflicts involving religion and values. And Dr. Haynes, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me, David. It's been a pleasure.
And also to mention, that, as I did at the beginning, that both of our guests this morning were honorees this year of the Council for America's First Freedom. This is an organization that's pretty particularly interested in the idea of religious freedom. Every year in January, they give out First Freedom Awards to people who have made a significant difference in this area. And this year, both of our guests were honorees.